Welcome to the talk show dedicated to the wine industry. It's All About Wine. With your host, winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida State's Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call our guest line at any time during the live show at area code 646-727-3235.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is educate people and make wine less confusing and more friendly.
Broadcasting on blogtalkradio.com and worldwide, including the Armed Forces Radio Network.
How this show has grown from, you know, maybe a couple hundred to over 40,000 people. And that's fantastic.
From coast to coast.
Basser, Kansas.
Deming, New Mexico.
Ithaca, New York.
Knoxville.
Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Lexington, Kentucky.
Montana.
Moscow, Idaho.
New Hampshire.
New Mexico.
Santa Rosa.
Sevierville, Tennessee.
South Dakota.
The coast of Maine.
The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Westport, Mass.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that. Alba Vineyards.
Blog.penlive.
Boyslip Winery.
Brotherhood.
Camas Prairie Winery.
Candia Vineyards.
Hello, the Borgeses.
Eagle Springs Winery.
Flathead Lake Winery.
Free the Grapes.
Grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery.
Hershey Harrisburg Wine Country.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery.
Hummingbird Ridge Winery.
Toy Soy of Wine.
Prairie Berry.
Rainborn Wines.
Rocky Top Wine Trail.
Sheila Lauer Vineyards and Winery.
Southwest Wine.
Haber Hill.
Ten Spoon.
University of Kentucky Extension.
Vineyard at Hershey.
Vibach Winery.
Walt Vineyard.
Westport Rivers.
Wine Flower.
And around the world.
TheDriftingWinemaker.com. I just arrived in Bali about 3 days ago.
All About Wine is on.
If you have any questions or anything to talk about, we will be more than happy to talk to you about or search it for you or try to find information for you out there, because there is a lot of information out there about wine.
We do occasionally get off topic.
Delvoir Winery.
The most well-known haunted winery in the Midwest.
I've heard voices at the winery.
Call area code 646-727-3235 and let's talk about wine on air. And now, wine enthusiasts and industry representatives, All About Wine is on. Here is your host, Ron.
Thank you, bus people. All right, here we are back again for another week of All About Wine. It is Thursday evening, December the 4th, 2014. If you are listening to this any other time, then we are not live. If you're listening to this now, then we are live. If you'd like to call in and you're listening to it, or if you listen to this on archive, you want to call and tune in when we're live, which is every Thursday evening, we will be more than happy to talk with you. Call us at 646-727-3235. Operators are standing by. Actually, no, there is an operator standing by because Mike's not with us again tonight. Aw. He's getting tied up on his new job that he has, and he's been scheduled every Thursday night, and this is the busy season for what he's doing. So he has not been with us. He has not been with us actually for the last couple, 3 weeks, but he says that he should be joining us within a week or so here. So actually he'll probably be back just about in time for us to take our 2 week break over the Christmas New Year stretch there. This year, December 25th and January 1st, both are on a Thursday evening, and we are not going to be doing shows on those evenings. So we're going to have ourselves a couple-week break there. But start back in January, going full force. We're not done with December yet, though. We have a guest tonight. Again, we're in Utah. We are still in Utah. We have a guest tonight. We have a guest next week, I believe, too. One has already said that he would be willing to come on next week. So Utah's been good. People want to talk. People want to talk about their wines in Utah, and so I'm thrilled about this. They something else I was going to bring up to all of you. This weekend, this Saturday, Florida Estates Winery is celebrating our 13th birthday. We are going to be 13 years old. We have been doing this for a long time. So 13 birthday. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. We'll have all sorts of goodies. We'll have cake. We're going to have birthday cake. We're going to have cheese and crackers and olives. And we'll have vendors. We'll have entertainment. We're going to do wine tastings, of course. All sorts of things going on. Talk about that more later. But as of right now, mark the date. That's only 2 days away. We're all getting excited because we made it into teenage years. As always, I want to remind you, RadioDJMike.com. Mike's not here, so he can't say thanks for it. But RadioDJMike.com, he does his shows every Friday and Saturday nights. Check it out. Go to RadioDJMike.com, and it'll give you the connections and everything. He takes requests. He talks to you on IM or all sorts of ways. He'll be happy to take any song that you like to hear and pop it on for you. Again, one more time, RadioDJMike.com. Our guest tonight is going to be Mike from a different Mike from Kyler, I believe it's pronounced Kyler Grove Winery in Salt Lake City, Utah. So, since Mike's not here, as always, I'm the one that's going to have to go get him. So, I'm going to put you all on our nice little jazz music in the background here for a little bit so I can go and grab Mike and bring him back. So, don't go away. We'll be back with you real soon. Oh, there I am. All right. We're back here. Mike's standing standing by. He's in the green room, and we're going to bring him out here in just a second. Mike from Kyler, I think it's Kyler Grove. He'll tell us how to pronounce this. So let's get him on the air. Hello, Mike. Welcome to All About Wine.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm doing great tonight. And yourself?
I think I'm going to make it.
Good. That's always a good thing. I don't want to see anything happen while we're on the air. number one, it's pronounced Kyler.
Yeah. Your eye, you know, when you see the word printed, your eye puts that extra L in there. It becomes killer.
Yeah.
But we're named after the place. We're the access to the vineyard is off of Kyler Canyon Road in Paso Robles.
Oh, okay. Okay, I was just going to ask how you came up with that name. So that's it. And again, Paso Robles is where you sort your grapes. That's in California. All the people should know that. I mean, Paso Robles is a big grape-growing area now. It's enormous. I've got your website up here. I always love to follow on the website whenever I talk to people about their winery. So how did Kyler Grove start? What is the backstory here on this?
Well, Kyler Grove itself was simply a function of the family, the immediate family of mine and my wife's, making a decision about 15 years ago to chip in and look for a piece of property that we could afford, stand up a vineyard, and then ultimately, if the quality of the fruit was agreeable, set up a winery. And so that was the intention, which we followed until we were until we had completed the process of getting a winery permit and so forth in the county of San Luis Obispo, and we met with some pretty nasty restrictions. Ultimately, we were denied the ability to have a tasting room, and so with that,
in Paso Robles, they denied you.
Right. Yeah,
that was really odd, because there are, 150 tasting rooms all around Paso Robles?
Right. I don't know how far you want to dig into that, but it had to do with the county at that time. This goes back to, I think we initiated the process in 2007, I believe, is when we did that. And at that time, the county of San Luis Obispo, which is the authority in
right.
the area that our vineyard resides, was in the process of developing, I think, what they called the collector, and it was sort of like they were trying to do something, very similar to what goes on in Napa Valley, up along the Silverado Trail and around Highway 26
right.
back to Napa and all that. And they were trying to establish that sort of a route for wine tasting, sensing that, the thing was going to grow and all that sort of thing. They wanted to have some sort of, order to the whole thing. And it was determined that if we were within 1 mile of the center line of this collector, then we would simply be beaten up. But if we were outside of that mile, we would be thrashed and hammered and run out of town with no ability to do business. So California, in its inimitable fashion, created some insurmountable restrictions, among which were no tasting room. We couldn't be open to the public.
Wow.
So that's the Cliff Notes version. I'd be happy to illuminate your listeners a little more, but that's the short version of it.
But the thing, last time I was at Paso Robles, they had tasting rooms up in the hills where you drive around bends and corners and everything, and finally you get up to the top of a hill, and here would be a tasting room, and then you take another branch in the road, and another half mile around the bend would be another tasting room, and they were everywhere. That just seems strange.
Indeed. However, I think you'll find that the vast majority of those, And there were probably, at the time of this application process, again, going back to 2007, there were probably 75 of those, I'm guessing, something on that order. We were hoping to be 76. We just happened, our nearest neighbor is a winery called Ecluse, and the Locke family owns that vineyard and winery. They were the very last winery, or application, I guess, that was allowed to have a tasting room, which was limited to appointment-only basis.
Wow.
We were the next ones in line, and we were denied, because, again, we were off this collector thing. We were denied altogether.
Wow.
And so it was just a matter of, bad timing, I guess. Had we gone through this process, a year earlier, perhaps, we would be, along with Ecluse, we would be open for business.
That is so odd, yeah.
Yeah. Yep, and we attempted, to get it mitigated. We lawyered up and did all that sort of thing, got some consultants on board who said, oh, they can't do this to you, this is not right, et cetera, et cetera.
You can't fight City Hall.
No, especially when it's as big as they get to be in California.
Yes. But, it just seems so odd, though, because you went from that, and I've talked to a couple other wineries that are in Utah, and you went from that and those rules and regulations to Utah?
Actually, I had been in Utah. I'm from... I lived, my early years were in the north end of the Napa Valley in a town called Santa Elena.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, the family moved over to the other side of the Mayacamas Hills there to the Sonoma Valley. And it was just around that stuff all my life. Ended up teaching over at University of California at Davis.
Wow.
And then followed teaching jobs, the last of which was intended to be in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I had no intention. I mean, my degrees were in English, physical education, art. You know, I have two BAs and an MA. And, you know, I was just intending to be a teacher. That's all I really wanted to do. Got over here in Utah, which is where I am currently. And the teaching job lasted for one semester, whereupon I was invited to freshen up my credentials, and I just said, you know what, I'm done with this. You know, I've been teaching for 7 years. I've got these, you know. Yeah, anyway, that's another long and dreary story. But the fact is that when I got here, when I arrived in Utah, because everywhere I had lived ahead of that move, I was in wine country or nearby it. Even when I was teaching at University of Nevada, Reno, UNR, there was a viticulture lab there. And I could hang out and stay in touch. And, you know, the Amador foothills are just over on the west side of Donner Pass there. I'm, you know, maybe an hour and a half away from. Yeah. So I move over here knowing full well that there was a, I call it a disposition, against alcoholic beverage. But I figured grapes grew everywhere. I mean, that had been my experience throughout my entire life. You know, they grow in the Sierra Nevadas. You know, they grow in the Great Basin. And so I just figured there'd be a vineyard here, and I could knock around in somebody's vineyard and do my thing. And turns out that's not the case. I was here for about probably 6 months before I realized that, no, you know, I'm now a fish out of water. I have been around wine and vineyards all my life. And I'm in my mid-40s at that point. So this was really quite a shock. And you know, that was accompanied by the epiphany, you know, that I've got to fix this. You know, somehow this has to be fixed, you know. So I ended up quite by accident discovering that there was a restaurant corporation here in Salt Lake City that had a window dressing vineyard around it. And so I got a hold of those folks and said, what are you doing with the grapes? And they shrugged their shoulders and said, huh? And I said, well, I'll see you in the fall. How about that? So ended up grabbing their grapes, and it was an interesting varietal. I won't go into that right at the moment, but again, trying to be a little bit, you know, the Cliff Notes version about the whole thing. Ended up making some wine out of the grapes, brought back, you know, in the spring when it was done. It was a white varietal, and said, here you go. Thank you very much. Do you mind if I come in the fall and get some more? And we did that for about 5 years.
Wow.
At which time the owner of the primary owner of that company said, gee whiz, this stuff's not all that bad. What do you say we make this the house wine? And I said, well, I'm making it in Rubbermaid, you know, trash bins in my garage. I think we need to tune that up a little bit. And so they offered to buy the equipment, and I just pay them back out of the proceeds. So we did that and established a winery, and I think it was the first production winery in northern Utah. I think we were winery number 4, something like that, in the state of Utah, and made their wine for them for, I think it was 14 or 15 vintages.
Wow.
All the while, the family was saying, let's get you back to California. You know, you're doing okay with this winemaking thing. Let's have you make wine for us, do-da-do-da. And that's how we wound up with the vineyard in Paso Robles, concurrent, you know, with what I was doing in the Salt Lake.
Wow. So the tasting room, the fermentation, everything else is all at one location, right? They're in Salt Lake City.
Yes, it is now. The facility that we had at the restaurant, first of all, the restaurant went through some really horrible stuff, which I won't go into now, but closed. And I think the last vintage I did for them was 2008. I since then, you know, stood up our vineyard, went through the process with the county that I mentioned earlier, and then made the determination to go ahead and try as an urban winery in Salt Lake City, you know, it's a little more metropolitan than folks might imagine. And, you know, some people who were familiar with my wines and me said, you know, heck with California, bring those grapes up here, and, you know, Salt Lake City is ready for an urban winery. And so that's, you know, really two separate things. I ended the relationship with the restaurant and then focused attention on trying to get the winery in California. When that was frustrated, met with frustration, then turned the focus to setting up something here in Utah.
Ah, wow. What a road to where you are now.
Yeah, it was interesting.
David Olson, I noticed on your website, partner mm-hmm. or relative? Or
yep. Yep, brother-in-law, partner.
Oh, okay.
Originally, it was myself, my wife, her sister, who is David's wife, and David, and the sister unfortunately passed away in 2003, and David decided he wanted to, you know, maintain. Again, this is ahead of all the difficulty we encountered with the regulations, but anyway, he wanted to assume his wife's interest in our little endeavor, and has been very supportive and you know, stuck with us for these years. And yeah, we've got a pretty nice vineyard going, well respected. We're making
very
some
good.
Decent wines
good.
Here in Salt Lake, and yeah, hanging in there.
The your wife Alva, is it pronounced?
Yes, Alva.
Is she California or Utah native?
Neither. She's Texan.
Oh.
as was her sister. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we met over in Reno while I was teaching over at UNR.
Uh-huh, okay. I thought maybe she was one of those two there because, you know, well, Texas throws a whole new wrinkle in it.
It sure does, yeah.
Yeah. The winery now, you were open when officially? 2000 and what?
Let's see, I think our official opening was the first week in January of 2011. That's when we had our hard opening, I guess they call it. We were operational in the fall of 2010, but hadn't declared, you know, openness.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the same with us. We're Florida Estates Winery. We're celebrating our 13th birthday this coming Saturday, but we actually opened, like, you know, 6 months ago, officially open on the January the 5th. But it was like 6 months before to do everything and get everything. And that's just, you know, you want to call it the hard opening is a good way to refer to it. So I understand that fully.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you have a vineyard in Paso Robles. Is that the only source of grapes or do you get other?
No. I try to bring in some other fruit. Now, there really aren't any commercially viable vineyards in Utah. Some folks have tried, and they, you know, made some huge blunders that I can share with you if you'd like. But nonetheless, not commercially viable vineyards. However, you know, about 250 or 300 miles north and south of us, there are some good vineyard areas. Boise, you know, the Snake River Valley. American viticultural area is a great grape growing area, and I think, you know, several dozen, maybe three dozen wineries are situated there.
Wow,
and then
is
in
there?
The,
wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I
and then
know
in the Palisades. Oh, pardon me, what was that?
I was just saying I didn't know there was that many in the Snake River area now. There's a lot of wineries
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then down in the Grand Junction, Colorado area, the Palisade area, which is just west of Grand Junction. It's quite a nice little grape-growing region down there. They've struggled a little bit with varietal selections, but they're getting it ironed out. There's a fellow down there, Carlson Vineyard, I believe it's called. I used to go to some competitions, the Southwest wine competitions that he entered along with our restaurant group and so forth. And he makes fruit wines, which you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, tutti frutti, you know, but when they're done well, you know, they're an attractive beverage. And he was doing a very good job with them, and he was getting gold medals for a wine that he it was based on pear was the flavoring element in it, and the name of the wine was Paradactyl.
Ah, that's cute.
Yeah, and it was really quite a nice wine. It was well balanced. I mean, he was very careful with his chemistry and flavoring and all that, and yeah, it did well. Anyway. Yeah, one of the better Viogniers I've ever had came out of a vineyard down in the Palisade area. Yeah.
Hmm. I know the western slope, the western banks of the Rockies there in Colorado is a big, big wine growing area now. And I understand they're putting out a lot of great grapes in that area. So that doesn't surprise me at all there.
Yeah, they suffered a little bit with varietal selection, but they're winnowing through their errors and you know, making good selections and, doing much better.
Yeah, I'm getting some I've talked to a couple of wineries there in the past, and it's exciting what they are doing in that area. Your vineyard in Paso Robles, how big is it, and what do you grow there?
Well, the parcel is close to 50 acres.
Wow.
But it's really rugged. Lots of little canyons, you know, very hilly. And we think, in fact, I was just talking with the consultant I work with over there here before you contacted me. And we think we have probably planted about everything that's reasonable to plant. And it amounts to about 17 or 18 acres out of that 50. Now, part of that is a function of the county when they were heaping restrictions upon us. They were also taking property, and naturally they took the best, most farmable portions of it. They didn't want us to be there. I mean, bottom line, they didn't want us to be there, and they were going to beat us up until we say, okay, we give and walk away. And so, you know, there was probably a good 5 acres, I'm guessing, somewhere in there, 5 or 6 acres. That is very plantable, that we would have planted had the county not claimed it as a taking.
As on what premise did they take your land?
Rights of way.
Conjured
up some rights of way. Well, you know, we might want to connect this thing with that thing, and that goes right here. And so we're taking this, and you're going to have to plan your winery for somewhere else, so start over, and we'll talk later.
Oh boy, I think I would still be bitter after all that.
Well, you may detect just a note of sarcasm.
Just a note,
it's,
yeah.
It's
just
about
a note.
5 years behind me, so I've definitely mellowed on.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You gotta move on.
Though. Yeah. Yeah, but still, though, it gnaws. Just gnaws.
Yeah, oh man.
I bet. Are you having any, I have to ask this, is California, are you having any water problems and hence any rain problems right now because of being in California?
Well, certainly, you know, we have been in that drought circumstance, you know, for
a long time.
Depending upon who you talk to, it's either 3 or 4 years. And that neighbor that I mentioned to you that had the last tasting room by appointment allotment, you know, that the county provided, they did run out of water for a period of time this past fall. Now, it's my understanding that they either deepened or added to their well structure somehow and managed to get some water coming in later in the year, even though there had been no rain. And I know of other properties not that far away from us that have totally lost their water. There was a major winery about a mile and a half to the south and west of us that had a pretty good-sized winery and I think about 30 or 40 acres of vineyard planted and lots of contracts on the fruit. And at some point, they went dry.
Ooh.
So certainly, yeah, and they were calling people saying, hey, you know, if you want any fruit at all from this contract, get over here and get it now because we're not going to be able to irrigate it from today forward, or something on that order occurred. And yeah, so there definitely were, you know, incidents of wells drying up or wells needing to be sunk deeper and that sort of thing. We, on the one hand, through this particular drought sequence, didn't suffer anything. I mean, you know, we thought maybe we would run out of water, but we didn't at all. The one water issue we did have was about 7 years ago. There was an earthquake in Paso Robles.
I remember
and,
that.
I think it was 2008, I think.
Yeah.
And the immediately thereafter, our vineyard manager called up and said, you know, hey, Mike, I something's wrong with the well. You know, you're not getting any water out of it. You know, can I call a well guy, you know? And I said, well, sure. And they ran a little camera down there, and about 150 feet down in a 360-foot well, they were looking at dirt and a broken pipe.
Ooh.
And apparently the strata that the well pierced had shifted and pinched off the well at about 150 feet. I mean, we couldn't pull a piece of wire out of there. It was, I mean, completely closed off. So we had to abandon that well and the pump and all that and sink a new one. But the new one has managed to get us through this drought. And I've noticed, you know, I'm watching all this long distance, of course, and I get over there about a half a dozen times a year. But right now, I'm just hearing that we're finally getting some rain over there. You know, it's not a drought breaker, I don't think. But
we're
ahead of normal for this time of year so far. But that's, you know, normal's like, you know, 2.5 inches of water, you know. I mean, you know, kind of, a lot of folks don't realize it, but aside from the you know, Sierra Nevada range, California is a desert.
It is. It really is. I lived outside of San Francisco up in Concord for many years, and you know, I just, you know, when you say brown grass, that's California. It's not by any means a lush green place to live.
And, you know, even where we are, you know, there, of course, have been a lot of vineyards put in. And our vineyard, it was an old walnut and almond orchard, which had ceased to be financially viable. I mean, the trees were anywhere between 100 and 75 years old, and they had simply stopped, you know. and there's nothing to replace them. But that brown grass that you're talking about, you had to get down into those little canyons and draws to see anything that was green. So the hills themselves, you know, tend to be that kind of barren brown grass stuff.
They do quite often, yes. And people don't understand that about California. It doesn't take much. Well, since we're talking about the vineyard there, let's, you know, a couple more questions about it. The summer highs, summer lows, winter highs, winter lows, what temperature are you getting there? What are you growing there?
About the only thing we don't get is heavy snow. we get about everything else. I mean, their temperatures will get down into the teens. I've seen it in Fahrenheit teens. Yep. I remember one day, and this tells you, this little statement here will tell you a lot about the area. And it's about 2 years ago, maybe three, I was out at our crush facility, which is on the west side of town, this little co-op thing that was out there, and finished up whatever I was doing, headed into town to the west, which is in the low spot. There's kind of a little dried river thing. The Salinas River goes through Paso there on the west side of it, or east side of it, sorry. And as I crossed that bridge, I looked on my truck thermometer, and it said it was 108. Now, I've actually seen 110 in a parking lot in town there. Well, anyway, I saw that and went, holy cripe, this is hot, you know. And, but I still had an errand to run, and which I did do, and finished it up, and then got up to the vineyard, which the town is about a 750-foot above sea level elevation. Our vineyard, where our pump house is and where I hang my hat, is about 1,200 or 1,300 feet elevation, something like that.
Wow.
And so 108 at about 4:30, get up to the vineyard, and it was about 102. And again, probably about 5:30. So, you know, somewhat cooler. And then looking out, I'm up high, so I'm looking out to the west, and I see the maritime air coming in over the Santa Lucia Range there.
Oh, yeah.
And I can see it. You know, you can see that stuff. It's
you
dense.
Can.
It's
yeah.
heavy.
Yeah.
It's very much cooler.
And
there.
It rolls.
It rolls right in there. And I think I probably was working around, fiddling around, maybe getting some dinner or whatever, went out and looked at the thermometer on the pump house, and it was down around 80. And this is probably about 7 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
And so now, and this is in July, by the way. And so then I go do something else, and I come back. It's probably dark. It's about 10 o'clock or something like that. And the temperature is in the high 60s. When I got up in the morning, now, and after that I went to bed. I didn't notice that anymore. And anyway, got up in the morning, you know, the vineyard's in full foliage. You know, everything's up in the second wire, so lots of leaves, lots of, you know, shoots and stuff. The vineyard wires are dripping with water. You know, the leaves are dripping with water. The eaves of the pump house have a puddle under them. And the sky is just as clear and blue, and the sunrise is coming up. And I'm going, what in the, you know, world is going on here? And it's just one of those things where, you know, the air is so dense, so cold, and it was condensing on everything. And I went over and looked at the thermometer on the pump house. It was chilly. It was 48.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, looking at 104, or, well, however you want to, you know, start this discussion,
yeah.
108 to 48 in a period of, what, 12, 13 hours, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And it was up to over 100 degrees, you know, by about noon that same day. So this, you know, this area has this enormous diurnal shift owing to, you know, the maritime air moving in and out as the sun, you know, passes the zenith and all that sort of thing. And that's just the way that area works. You get hot during the day, you get the continental heat during the day, and then in the afternoon and evening you get that maritime air, and you get these really wonderful things happening to the grapes. I mean, they get full metabolic ripeness, and then cool enough to retain the acids, so you get these marvelously rich but well-balanced wines that come out of these vineyards around there. It really is an amazing place.
Yeah, and that's, you know, you mentioned that, and that was a great description, because that's what happens up and down California, Napa and Sonoma, and, you know, you get on up to Ukiah area and stuff. It all has that rolling in from the ocean that gives you that instant cool at night, which is one of the reasons why there's so many wineries in California. So
certainly, yeah. You know, as we get along, you know, in Mendocino County and all that, you don't get so much of that continental heat. but, you know, it becomes a really great, you know, Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris area, Chardonnay area, that sort of thing. But certainly south of that, the Sonoma Valley and Napa, they get that maritime either from the ocean itself, from the Pacific, or up from San Francisco Bay, one or the other.
Right, yeah, a lot of it now.
Get that really cooling effect, you know, from the maritime air. Yeah, it's great. Amador foothills are a little bit different than that. They just get heat.
Yeah.
And they get some cooling by virtue of the elevation, I think.
But not much.
not much, no. It's a pretty warm place.
Yeah.
Boy, there's some old vineyards along there, though. There's some old ones in that.
Oh, in those hills, they've been there for ages. It just is amazing that they continue to just thrive like they do. So you have your vineyard, you harvest your grapes, you come back. Now, I'm looking at your wines here. Well, to begin with, do you use stainless steel? Do you use oak? Do you use plastic? What is your...
All the above. It just depends on...
Plastic,
you know,
bags and trash cans? What, you know?
Yeah. Actually, I've got something similar to that, which I'll confess to you, just because I think it works so damn well. and that is, as you and your folks are probably well aware, oxygen, you know, in large doses is the enemy of wine. And one of the best means available to people like me who have serious logistical issues, you know, about the vineyard being 800 miles away, you know, how do you transport juice and wine? Barrels are not the answer, by the way. You get outside of California and nobody knows what to do with a barrel. And so the transporters have created some huge problems for me. So I ended up going to the what's called an intermediate bulk container. Tote is the sort of the jargon for that container. It's a metal cage with a high-density polyethylene bottle, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And they're around 300-gallon capacity, something on that order. But you have to get the wine in and out of those in a hurry, or you will get over-oxidation of the wine. Well, in some cases, you know, that wine might sit in that tote, for my operation anyway, for a couple of months. And that's just death, you know, to the wine. And so I was, because of the oxygen transpiration through that material, through the HDPE material, I found some companies, one in particular, that manufactures a low gas permeability, very low gas permeability liner that inflates inside the IBC bottle, essentially.
Oh.
And, yeah, allows me, I've stored probably the longest storage duration was about 6 months with no deleterious effect to the wine, simply
amazing,
because
amazing
of that gas impermeable bag that's in there, like wine in a, you know, wine in a box.
Wine in a box, yeah, that's
kind
it.
Of an idea, yeah, exactly mm-hmm. that idea. And so that has been very helpful. Yeah, logistics, when you're this far away from your grape source, are huge. I attempted to bring some of, I grew a grape called Trebbiano. Some of your folks may know it as Uni Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And thought I could hustle it up here. It's 800 miles away, and you're crossing, you know, Baker, California, and they call it that for a very good reason, you know. And then Las Vegas, and yeah. So by the time I got here, my fruit was so beat up, and you know, some native fermentation had already launched in it. And I ran hard, and it was like a 14-hour drive, and got here, and the grape temperature was 92. I mean, it was horrible. So anyway, that became I almost couldn't make wine out of that stuff. So it became a real challenge to find out how am I going to do this, and that's where the tote idea came about over a few bits of trial and error. I wound up with that tote idea. And so I can bring juice and or new wines up here. I just don't, unless I'm carrying the barrels don't come up here anymore.
Oh, you do it all now then? Oh.
Do it all, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm a chicken. I don't fly. And besides, I'm usually either taking something back to the crush pad or bringing something up from it or to the vineyard or whatever, a piece of equipment, whatever. And it's almost impossible to even think about flying.
Yeah.
But even if it were, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I know what keeps those things in the air.
Yes.
And it isn't much. Yeah.
It's air. That's all. That's
it's
all.
It's
air.
It's pretty thin stuff. Yeah.
And that's
yeah,
it.
So.
Yeah. Well, you said you use plastic and oak and stainless steel.
Yep.
That's unusual to use all three. That, well, the plastic you just described, but the stainless steel and oak. What oak are you sourcing?
Well, I don't think I've ever bought a new barrel. I was trying to think about that. I don't believe I've ever bought a new one. This goes over, you know, like a 30-year stretch, so I'm having, you know, a little trouble remembering all that. But I don't believe so. I don't believe I've bought a new barrel. I have, hung around other wineries and said, oh, gee, I've got this is the third vintage for this thing. Don't know what I'm going to do with this barrel. And I'll say, I'll take it.
Get rid of it. Yeah.
As long as I know the pedigree, you know, and I don't mind taking it. And so all of the barrels, and I mean, you know, it amounts to hundreds, have been used. And some, I think I've even got some barrels that are, I'm going to say maybe were made in the late 60s or early 70s, something on that order. And as long as they don't have fur on the outside or stank on the inside, I use them.
Are they not split?
Nope. And I've rehydrated some pretty seriously dried out barrels just because I needed the darn thing. I mean, you could read a newspaper through it and rehydrated it, put it back in the system. If I decide, and as you might be able to tell, I don't lean on oak at all.
No.
But I have wines that just sort of murmur out of the barrel and say, hey, Mike, we could use a little more of that vanilla or a little more tannin or whatever. Then I try to pay attention, and that's when I use the oak ads, and that's as close as I come. There was a fellow that was trying to get some first use white oak barrels, and they were Navarre, I believe, or Allier wood, and he wanted to get rid of them, and I took them. Didn't want to use them for my program, so what I did was took them apart and cut them up. made a bunch of little sticks.
So I could flavor up my,
there you go. A little interstave sort of idea there.
Yeah.
And even baked some. And, you know, when I was working for that restaurant corporation, they had these giant bread ovens, and I baked some of the wood to, you know, dark toast. And then linked them with knife ties and used those in my interstave program.
Oh, that's great. I love that. So let's your wines now. You mentioned the wines. Let's talk about each one. Your dry Riesling from Boise area?
Yeah.
And you make this in a sweet or a dry, real dry style? Semi.
Well, I inadvertently made one with about 3 or 4% residual sugar here about 3 years ago, I guess, something on that
That's
order.
Sweet, yeah.
Yeah, palpably sweet. Well balanced, so it was really a delightful wine. About 6 months later, I noticed that some of the bottles on the shelves were pushing corks.
Uh-huh.
So. Yeah, well, this
it started another
unwelcome
fermentation. Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently, it had to go back. I only had one at the time. I only had one sterile filter, which I had employed in the bottling of that wine, knowing, you know, that it had residual sugar. I didn't want any little, taggers along in the bottle. And so I put it through that sterile filtration. And so I went back and reviewed that, you know, what could be the problem, and I found that there was a little filament like a scrubby, you know, that had a little filament to come off of it, you know, those little 3M scrubbies that you might use the winery, and it had gotten embedded. There's a little annular ring around the top of the filter cartridge. And it was just laying there, and it was still stuck to it, you know, 6-8 months later, whatever it was. And I went, oh, man, how did I miss that? And after I got to thinking about it, I actually had one of my volunteer cellar rats set up the filter and just didn't notice it, you know, and got it trapped in there. And so we were doing a micro-inoculation of this bottling run after some point. And fortunately, the majority of that wine, and it wasn't much. We don't make much. I mean, our total production is like 600 cases. And I think this batch was maybe 50 cases or 60 cases, something like that. And the majority of it had been consumed because it was just delicious and people bought it to drink it. But I still had probably about 20 cases of it in my inventory, and I had to decant those buggers. Put them back through that filter, that same filter, minus the little piece of fur that was on there.
Oh, yeah.
And put it back on the shelf. So that's the one exception to the otherwise dry Rieslings. I really like that Alsatian-style Riesling, and apparently my customers do too. Again, I don't make much of it. I think I've got about, 180 gallons of it. Finishing Mallow right now, and that's it for this year. And it's in stainless, getting back to your container question.
Right.
It's a pretty popular wine. It's almost as popular as my Trebbiano.
Well, people come in all the time to me and say, oh, I love a Riesling, and I say dry or sweet. And people immediately think Riesling should be sweet. And so that was interesting that you said it's very popular with your customers, because most people think sweet when they think Riesling.
Yeah, and I'm careful to warn them. You know, again, this is not, you know, we are not surrounded by wine connoisseurs and mavens here. You know, it's a
we are Salt Lake City, Utah. Yeah, nothing against you. I love you, Salt Lake City, but
you're getting there, but not quite yet. And so I tell them, look, this is a dry Riesling. You know, if you're used to the, you know, light sweet version, this will be different. And you're welcome to, you know, cover your glass with your hand, and I'll skip you. But they seem to, it's, like I say, it's almost as popular as her Trebbiano, which is
that's,
interesting.
That's,
they just about go hand in hand.
Rosé, what?
Yeah.
What are you doing to get your pink wine? Everybody has their own rosé or blush. What are you doing to get yours?
Well, I've done both the Saunier and Pressé styles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll explain that if you need to, but two different methods of evolving a rosé. And I have found that I prefer the Pressé. And so that's what we do. We actually we'll crush our, we'll pick out a certain allotment of the Merlot and the Grenache. That's what our rosé is comprised of.
Always.
And always.
Okay.
And we'll, even when we do the Saunier, it's Saunier from, the Merlot and Grenache.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, it kind of depends on, the exact ripeness of the phenolics and that sort of character in the grape, but somewhere between 4 and I think the outside 8 hours is the most I think we've left the skins and juice together before pressing.
That's not long.
That's just that's it. I mean, we just look for color and a little more mouthfeel coming out of it. We actually look for, there's a character I call it Hawaiian punch.
Everyone can relate.
Good descriptor.
Yes, I know.
Yeah,
it is.
And when we start to get that sense, that sensory effect of Hawaiian punch, then we know that we've got to separate the juice and the skins and get busy here, because we don't want it to go much into that territory. But that's how we do it, and it's always the same, very much the same combination. I mean, it might emphasize Merlot to a slight extent on one vintage, and next vintage it might emphasize Grenache, depending upon what we're actually getting out of the vineyard.
Well, then this moves us right into the trio, and you use the Merlot
and
Grenache along with Zinfandel in that one.
Yeah, that one is a new one to us. I mean, obviously, our vineyard, is home to Rhone varietals. And I didn't even include Zinfandel in that category, by the way, although I know that's a little bit of a stretch. It is native to the, Adriatic area, really Mediterranean region, and you could argue it's the southern portion of that land mass and not that much removed from the Rhone, and is where it's native. And it does very well at our site, as do the Grenache. We have a little trouble sometimes ripening the Merlot. It likes the heat. And we don't sustain the heat during the day that much, so it's probably the last to come off every vintage. And the Petit Sirah, which of course is the Duraf of southern France, and so it's really home. Even the Trebbiano, you could argue, well, that's clones of it are Uni Blanc, which is a southern France native, I think. And so that's where we are. That's what we do. And so I'm fiddling with some of those classic Rhone blends.
Mm.
Even though we don't grow Syrah, we grow the Merlot, we grow the Grenache, we have the Duraf, which, is part and parcel of that whole territory. So one combination that we came up with, we call interpretation, because it's my interpretation of a Rhone blend, which is Merlot Grenache and Petite.
Oh.
And at some point this winter, when we were doing the blending trials, getting ready for blending and bottling, it's just one of those things, we had the wines out on the table, we're moving around, trying some different stuff, what goes with it this year as opposed to last year, and I just happened to get a whiff of Zinfandel at some occasion when I had the Grenache and the Merlot already blended. And went, wow, there's something going on there. That's kind of attractive. What was that? And went back to the little Zin beaker and started fiddling around with that, and ended up, I think we ended up with about 50% Grenache, 25% Merlot, and 25% Zin. And because it was those three grapes, I named it Trio. And it turns out that it really is a quite attractive combination, and I hadn't tried it before.
It sounds interesting.
Well,
it really jumped out at me as I was looking at these different wines, and it just sort of like the Zin seems like it would give a lot of depth to it and a lot of color.
It does, and in this year, our Grenache came off so early. I mean, it reached metabolic ripeness really ahead of phenolic ripeness, and so we didn't have the good skin character that we were used to having from our Grenache. Again, the drought and heat and all that sort of contributed to all of that. Boy, it was a really compressed harvest. That's another story. But nonetheless, it needed something, and I had already, put in more Merlot than I was comfortable with, and I was, just sitting there in front of that beaker with that combination in it, like I say, and got a whiff of that Zin and went, wait, there's something going on here. What's the deal? And a lot of that's trial and error. There's no recipe book out there. I wasn't bashful about, grabbing a little eyedropper full of the Zinfandel and going tweak, and went, I think I'm onto something here. And so it became Trio.
I grabbed my pipette and my 5-milliliter pipette when I'm doing that, and I'm doing, a little bit here and a little bit here. Write it down, ooh, bad, cross it out, do it again. That's same principle whenever I'm mixing stuff up there. So,
I don't know of another way. I think that's
that's
standard,
the only way to
standard ops, I think.
Yeah. 14.2% alcohol in that, too, so that's a little bit higher there.
How to say this? In Paso Robles, you're going to get sugars. You just can't, by the time that fruit ripens, you've got 27 bricks or you've got 28 bricks.
Wow.
And you're going to have, probably mid-3s pH.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way the fruit comes off. And, your TAs are probably going to be around 6.5, something like that. That's it. That's life in the Paso Lane.
With your hot days and cold nights. That's going to retain that. Yeah.
And so you can fight that. You can just go ahead and let it get ripe. With all the indicators you want. Seeds or rachis lignification or whatever you're looking for, whatever you think is the deal. And bring it to the crush pad, and you're going to have 28 bricks, and you're going to have 3.4 pH or whatever. And so your choices are learn to love it or stand there half the night with your garden hose. to get my drift. To get the pH up and sugars down. So,
And
believe me.
And there's no
people...
garden hose long enough. So that answers that question.
It's just the way it is. My strategy is to just own that and just say, that's what it is. And so that's what this vineyard produces. I'm not going to fight that. I'm going to try and encourage the best iterations of those fruit within those parameters. But that's it. I'm not going to try and hide the fact that it's high Brix fruit. I'm not going to hide the fact that it's low pH and high TA. I'm just going to work with it and try to maneuver it into the best iteration of that wine that it can be.
I'm really interested in trying wine, and I will try your wines this summer. I have to say, my daughter works at Salt Lake City Airport. She lives up in Ogden. I will visit her this summer.
Wow.
I will visit you this summer, and I'm definitely looking forward to trying some of these because, to bring that total acid in balance with that pH and those sugars and all that has to be a chore every time you do something. And
it's a nail biter.
Yeah, to say the least, yes. Your late harvest Zinfandel, your port style, since we can't say port, your port style wine, that sounds interesting. Is it, what your residual sugar on that?
It's around 4%.
That's not that high then, really.
No, it's not, yeah, it's, I call it port light. I've tried on probably 4 or 5 occasions to hit the mark on that one. Zinfandel is a grape that, you know, as soon as it hits ripeness, tomorrow it wants to be a raisin. It's that kind of has that kind of character. And you know, obviously you can make a wine out of raisins, but it tastes
like
prune juice, cough syrup. But I wanted some of that, and we get the good blackberry character in the Zins, you know, and some smokiness, a little spiciness, and I wanted that. I didn't want raisins. I didn't want prune juice. And so, you know, like I say, I tried to hit that mark several times, but in 2010, it was actually a cool growth year, and we were able to let it hang without it turning to raisin, and grabbed it. And at that time, and still ongoing, we have 2 active distilleries in the Paso Robles area there, one of whom was in the part of the co-op that we were in. And I just said, you know, is there any chance I can grab some of that distillate before you send it off to flavor, you know, whether that's, you know, oak or whatever you're doing. And he agreed to do that. So we ended up adding just really neutral brandy spirit to halt the fermentation. And so the alky is up around 17.5, I think it is, and the sugars are around 4% residual, something on that order. So it's palpably sweet and definitely, you know, it's well integrated, but you could definitely get some alcohol heat in it. And it's kind of a aperitif, you know, desserty kind of thing, as long as the dessert isn't real sweet. You know, you don't want to serve it with a wedding cake, you know. But but with a, you know, nice semi-sweet chocolate brownie, yum-yum.
Or cigar. That's
the one, you know, if I have just a second to tell you, this one dessert that's hostess fed us with my wine was cooked in a little ramekin, like looked like a creme brulee. It was in a little crust and had this custard material in it. And she simply shaved with like a potato peeler, strawberries and kiwi and pear into that little thing. And it was fabulous with that wine. So, you know, fruits that are, you know, ripe and sweet, creamy dishes like that, you know, especially it had that little crust, which was, you know, crunchy and nice on it. That was really a nice combination.
That sounds like it would be. That really does. The more you think about it, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it was
good. I can imagine. Your 2012 Trebbiano is your grapes from your vineyard on that.
Are you asking, did we get the grapes from our vineyard?
Yes.
Indeed. You know, back when we were getting ready to build our own vineyard, I recalled, you know, back when I was a kid, you know, I had an Italian uncle in the family, and when my mother got fed up with my brother and I, she shipped us off to Uncle Gino, and Uncle Gino, militant bugger, insisted that we have wine with our lunch. I guess that was sort of a European tradition. He was fresh over. He and his mom had escaped, fascist Italy, got out of there before it all came apart. And so he was fresh into the U.S. and, you know, keeping some of those traditions. And when the kids were there, I think we were about 10, when he started giving us wine for lunch. And one of them was this horrid, I mean, you couldn't dilute it enough to make a drinkable red wine. And then this other one, which we all liked, my cousins and my brother and I liked it. And when it came time to plant the vineyard, I gave him, Uncle Gino was still alive, and I called him up and said, what was that stuff? And he gave me the name, it was Trebbiano d'Abruzzo. And he said, good luck, you know, I don't know where you're going to get it. And so I called around and found a vineyard that had an actual, you know, Trebbiano clone or Trebbiano selection. It wasn't Uni Blanc. And planted it on a dare. You know, the family was all upset that I would waste an acre.
And the money to do this, yes.
But turns out to be well-suited to the site and makes delightful wines. I sell some fruit to this winery called Pacer Terre in Paso, and he makes a low bricks version of it. He has me pick it, I think it's 21 bricks, something like that. And so it's this minerally, you know,
dry.
Austere, dry, but really just a mouthful of flavor wine. And I bring it in much later than that. I bring it in around 24, 24 and a half, something like that. And get a little more fruit character out of it. I get a little grapefruit, a little kiwi kind of character in it that folks seem to like, and I like. You know, it just reminds me of Uncle Gino's wine, so I like it. I'm imprinted.
Hey, that's what it takes. Your Red Thriller, you're sold out. Obviously a good one, or you just haven't made any more?
I haven't made any more. That one, it was just leftovers. I mean, I had gone through all of my blending and done all that. Plus, somebody... And again, we're in this co-op, and some things happen that are difficult to explain. And at some point, somebody left a barrel of Malbec in my little section of the co-op area there. And it was late at night before I discovered it. Everybody was gone. And I attempted to find, the next day, I attempted to find who had made that mistake. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew, and I don't even know who grows Malbec around there, to tell you the truth. And all it said on the barrel is 2010 Malbec. That was it. No vineyard, no winery, no nothing. Mm-hmm. And so we put a little notice up on the bulletin board there, and I think after about 10 months, when I was getting into my next blending cycle, I just said, here goes.
We need to do something with this, yeah.
And the name comes from something we do in our kitchen when we're cleaning out the refrigerator, you know, and there's, you know, wobbly carrots and, you know, wrinkled tomatoes and a chunk of chicken that's got interesting colors. You throw it into the crock pot and it becomes Chicken Thriller. So in this case, you know, it was everything, including somebody else's Malbec, so it became Red Thriller.
Red Thriller. And obviously it sold because...
It did. Yeah, it was a delightful wine, actually. I just couldn't tell folks where it came from.
Yeah, really. Well, you need to make more of this. Okay, we'll have to find somebody to bring me some more Malbec.
Yeah. Would you please come forward with your Malbec?
Come forward with your Malbec. Your interpretation, we were talking about blends earlier. This is your Rhone blend.
Yes. Yes, it is. And, you know, I even ask folks, have you been to the south of France? You know, have you tasted some of those Grenache Merlot blends? And then once in a while I'll have somebody say, yeah. And then I'll ask them, well, how does this stack up? You know, and of course, usually they're pretty polite and say, oh, it's pretty good, or whatever. And so I stopped asking because I figured they're not going to tell me the truth anyway.
Anyway, no,
but,
they don't.
Yeah, but it's a popular wine, and it's a, you know, $20 a bottle of wine with lots of aromatic character. You know, it's got, you know, good red fruit, some spicy things. There's an aromatic character that is really talks about our vineyard. As I mentioned, you know, we're in this Kyler Canyon, is where it's located, and you have to drive through this little oak grove. That's where the name comes from, Kyler Grove. And when I get out of the truck to open the gate to get into the vineyard itself, there is this smell. And if anybody's been in one of those California oak grove locations, you know, with the leaves on the ground and all that sort of stuff and milled around enough to stir up the aromatics of it, that aromatic is in that wine.
It
really speaks of the, you should pardon the expression, terroir, of that area. And again, this sort of dusty, spicy kind of aromatic on the nose and good rich flavors. Real nice wine, if I do say so myself.
Yeah, well, you have a right to. The Zinergy, back to the interpretation. How much of the each of the three do you have? What's your bling?
It's pretty much evenly split between Grenache and Merlot at about 40%. And the balance is Petit Syrah.
I see. Okay. This is Zinergy. Another one that is sold out.
Actually, the 2010 vintage is sold out. The 11 is in the bottle waiting for labels.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. In fact, I need to do that, too.
They should have been here weeks ago, but...
You can
don't
never
get
count
me started
on it. Yeah, I know. this another blend. of Zin Petit Sirah Grenache?
Right. It actually, of course, I knew long ago. I mean, again, when I was a kid in Sonoma County, there's a vineyard up near Healdsburg called Foppiano, and they had field blends of Zinfandel and Petit Sirah and other things as well. And you know, so I knew long ago that those two had a synergy. You get it so far?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, and so when it came time again to plant our vineyard, I knew I had to have Petit Sirah. I was pretty sure I had to have Zinfandel, and so yeah, planted those. And later, when I started doing the blends of them, as I knew I would be doing, one of those little blending trial epiphanies. Here's some Grenache sitting here, and holy mackerel, it's bringing something to the party. And it's not much. It doesn't take much. You know, there's kind of an alchemy that goes on in there, and it doesn't take much. It's usually about 5% of Grenache in there. And at some point, I got carried away with myself and decided I needed to trademark that word, synergy. This goes back, probably 12, 15 years, something like that. So, and it takes a while to do that, and I don't recommend anybody doing that. It was stupid. Nonetheless, I did it, and about the time that it got recorded, they recorded at the U.S. Patent Office or someplace, I got a call from somebody representing Ravenswood.
Oh, no!
I'm thinking, oh, my God, I went through all this process, and I'm stomping on somebody's toes, and it was the other way around. Actually, they wanted the name. And, again, I had just come off that process, and it took, like, 3 years. It probably cost several thousand dollars at least.
Whoa.
I don't know, maybe $5,000. I don't know. It was a bunch of money. But I kept thinking, well, I've got it this far. I might as well finish it up. You know, that one of those kind of fool's errands. And, anyway, so whoever it was, and I don't remember if it was their lawyer or if it was their marketing manager or whoever. Nonetheless, he said, understand, you own the word synergy. And I said, and they said, well, we specialize in Zinfandel wines, and we'd sure like to have the use of that, and wondered if you'd be willing to sell it. And I said, well, maybe. What are we talking? And he said, well, not very much. And I said, okay, goodbye.
That's the end of that. Yeah.
End of that.
You people don't understand.
Yeah. You should have talked to me a couple of years later, you silly devil, because I just finished writing that last check, and it was a fat one.
Anyway,
that was a fun story with that. But nonetheless, yes, Zinergy.
Zinergy.
Tyler Groves, Zinfandel Petit Grenache blend.
And to end up with Grenache, you have yourself, in fact, your 2010 Grenache, as it looks like probably all of them, you spend more time in oak than any of your other wines. You're looking at, 28 months in oak with this?
Yes, and, there's really no recipe for that. It was more a function of, okay, I've done the blends I want, and now I've got, three barrels of Grenache left over. What am I going to do?
So you just threw it in oak.
Right. So I scratched my head for a while and, top up the barrels and talk to somebody else and, 4 or 5 months later, say, gee, I should be bottling this for my own program. I guess I'll do that. So it's more of a thing like that than it is, this really needs, 28 months in oak. It doesn't. And it's neutral oak, so it's not picking up, flavors. It's just really neutral stuff. And I try to make sure that if anything is left over after, the blending is actually done and I've emptied barrels, then I try to put whatever wine's left in the most neutral barrels remaining. So I go to that amount of trouble again because I'm trying to keep the oak monster away and invite them in only when I think I'm ready for a little dose here and there.
I don't use oak at all in any of my wines. I tell people, no oak. If you detect oak, then it's not my wine you're drinking. So it's just, I don't oak. It's just a decision I made and keep all my wines light and fruity. So.
Well, I've had folks that have really good sniffers tell me they can pick up some oak. And I think that's more a function of, whatever they were sniffing came out of one of my newer barrels, but, you know, it certainly isn't a new one. I just, like I say, don't have any new ones.
Yeah, just, you know, some oak out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excuse me. So we hit on a little bit, but the Utah government, how are they treating you? Good, bad, indifferent? Are you pointing the crew to change, or what's going on?
Well, you know, nobody's going to change anything about the way Utah does liquor. It's just not in the cards. You can carve, you can scream, you can yell, you can make a good case, you can have, you know, you can buy a legislator a drink. It's not going to change. And what I found is that basically, as far as setting up a winery, they basically rubber stamp whatever the Fed does.
Oh.
And so I found the process of getting the state license far more easy than California. And then when you stack on top of that the prospect that we're doing here in Utah what I was disallowed in California, it really should change the tenor of the discussion, you know. And then, moreover, the one that's really a killer, amazing thing is that the controlling authority for the winery was the city of South Salt Lake. That's whose zoning I had to answer and whose conditional use permit process I had to go through with. And that same process, conditional use permit, that's sort of standard ops. I think all the communities have that. Whenever you're changing, you know, the use of a property. And in California, the conditional use process took not quite 3 years, probably cost me about $90,000.
Whoa.
And when we were done, I was denied a tasting room. That big easement was taken. I was told that if I didn't currently grow it on my vineyard, I couldn't have it in my winery. There were some other things. You know, the 4 or 5 of those really significant restrictions were applied. The conditional use process in South Salt Lake went something like this. I called them up on a Friday morning, probably about 11 o'clock. Said, here's what I want to do. I found a piece of property that I can afford, and it's in your municipality. It's apparently zoned right. Here's what I want to do. They said, gee, you know, we have no clue how to handle this. Can I call you back? So I'm thinking, yeah, sure.
Okay.
Got a call probably 10 minutes later. Said, can you be here at 2? And I said, well, okay. And so I went to the city hall. Into the meeting room where they had the city attorney, the chief planning official, the some authority from the sewer and water department, and somebody else. There were four officials in the room, each of whom had questions, and probably interviewed with them for about 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the chief planning official said, well, I think I've got all my questions answered. How about you, Mr. Attorney? How about you, Mr. Whatever? Everybody said, okay. And they said, fine, we'll have to put you before the planning commission, which is the kiss of death, of course. I said, oh, geez, okay, well, what's it going to cost, and how long is it going to take? And they said, well, you know, you're going to have to pay this fee, this fee, this fee, and send out letters to everybody, and that's going to cost about $300. And I said, well, okay, I can do that. And when does this happen? Uh-huh. Well, it happens next Tuesday. And so start to finish, I was less than a month into the process, $300 and some odd out of pocket. It was more like $350, I guess, and was given my conditional use permit.
Oh,
so you
wow.
contrast those two. And the real interesting one is you have to send letters out to neighboring properties advising them that you're changing the use. Again, standard ops, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In California, I had to send out, I think it was 9 letters. And in South Salt Lake, I had to send out something approaching 60, you know, because we're in town, you know.
Yeah, right.
Whereas, you know, California, it's all rural. I mean, my property's 50 acres, the next guy's 100, you know, that kind of thing. So there's only 9 people that were, you know, in the
close
range,
yeah,
that I had to notify. Yeah. Every single one in California either showed up at the hearing to complain or sent a letter to the commissioners with a complaint to be
read. Oh, my gosh.
At the hearing, yeah. In South Salt Lake, not one. So, you know,
that's just amazing.
Utah definitely deserves to be chafed a little bit because of their stuff, you know, with the disposition, I call it. But, you know, in fact, it's not their fault. It goes back to the original error, which was when, you know, the federal government decided it wanted to be in the liquor business and then decided that was a dumb idea. And did the prohibition thing and ended up giving up on that. But instead of just giving up on it, they just said, you know what, we don't want to be in the liquor business. That's weird. But we really love the revenue from it. So each of you states is going to be in the liquor business, and you just do it the way you want.
Give us money, though. And, yeah.
Yeah, but send the money. This is the address to send the money to, yeah. And
right.
So it was free for all, you know. So, you know, those states that had a theological disposition remaining, you know, or a carry nation sort of disposition remaining, applied that strategy to how they were going to be in the liquor business. And the Fed didn't care, you know, just send us the dough. We don't care. It's your
Utah.
Thing.
Being one, along with Kansas, and along with, you can name three or four others that are locked into that. Yeah, that's sad, but true.
Well, it is. And so we do some pretty ridiculous stuff. You know, if you ever come to my tasting room, you will see the Zion curtain.
I heard about the Zion curtain. Yeah. Last week, I talked to, who was it last week? It was Jay up at the Hive Winery.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And he explained the Zion curtain to me. I was shocked. And then after I talked to him, I started talking to my daughter, and I'm saying, about this Zion curtain. She goes, you can't believe it, Dad. You can't believe it.
Yeah. And he's one who fantasizes that he can put some pressure in the right spot and get Utah to change. And I wish him well, but I think it's a forlorn hope. Not that Utah can't, because it has. You know, when we were recording the Olympics, we really did improve our liquor laws and you know, the accessibility of adult beverages. And so it can happen, but it has to be a really unusual set of circumstances where we have a user-friendly governor, we have a user-friendly legislature, and we have some cause celeb that's driving the whole thing. And in the case of the Olympics, you know, obviously that was a big deal, you know. And it takes something like that to get movement in the liquor statutes here. But until that set of circumstances, you know, reforms, we're stuck. And, you know, Jay, bless his heart, he can tilt windmills all he wants, but I don't think there's going to be any positive outcome, frankly.
Any immediate change. Well, that's too bad on that aspect. But you guys are doing great, though. I talked with Jay last week, and then the week before that, I talked to Doug McCombs from Iron Gate, or Instant Gratification, rather, winding down the south. And you guys
is that
are
what
all
he's
doing
calling it? Is that what he's calling it? Because it started out as Iron
Instant
Gate.
Gratification, yeah, IG. You know, you can't call it Iron Gate because he said he got himself a nice little letter from a winery in New Zealand who said, Iron Gate is our name. You cannot use it. So he changed it to IG, and he refers to it as Instant Gratification. So Instant Gratification winery.
Well, I knew that he was going IG. I just didn't know what the motive was.
It is because a winery in New Zealand said, that's our name. You can't do that. So,
darned. What a world.
Yeah, I know. So before we let go, give us all of your contact information, your address, your phone number, your Facebook account, your website, everything. So everybody out there, if they want to get a hold of you or if they're in Salt Lake City, can look you up.
Okay, great. First of all, I guess the winery address is 53 West Truman, you know, like President Harry S. Truman,
Harry
Avenue,
yes.
South Salt Lake, and that's the name of the town, Utah, 84115. And our web URL is www.kylergrovewines.com. And my email is just mike@kylergrovewines.com. Our phone number is area 801-746-0977. We are on Facebook and Twitter, but I don't manage that stuff. The lady that is closing up the tasting room right now does that, and she's on her way out the door. Or I ask her, what do we do?
Just Facebook/Kyler Grove. And I want to point out to everyone, too, it's Grove, not Groves. So if you look it up, there's no S on it, Grove.
Correct. It's Grove, like, of trees.
Yes.
Grove, singular. There you go.
Yeah. And let's see, phone number and all that? Oh, that great. All right. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time out this evening and talking with us. It has been a great pleasure, very informative. I've enjoyed it tremendously. I am seriously looking forward to meeting you this summer. I am going to be taking a trip out to visit my daughter, and whether she wants to go down to visit you or not, I will be down there. So.
Okay, great. Yeah, Utah's great in the summer. Hope you do make that trip.
Plan on it. Well, she works for Southwest, so it gives me an opportunity to get out there pretty easily. So.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, thanks, and good night. And best wishes to you.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thanks again for taking the time to join us, and best wishes to you also.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. All right. There we go. Thank you very much. It was great. It was an interesting program and a lot of information. That was enjoyable. I really did enjoy that. You can tell he was a teacher. He had this ability to just talk, and that's something a teacher needs. So there we go. We only got a couple of minutes left on the show here, about 3 minutes. During that time, I need to squeeze in. I'm not going to play the clip because the clip is too long, so I'm just going to tell you. This Saturday, 2 days from today, actually one full day, and then the next day is our 13th birthday party. Yay! So, you all need to come out if you're in this area, if you're in the Florida area, if you're in the Tampa area. We are north of Tampa, 25241 State Road 52, Land O'Lakes, Florida, Florida Estates Winery. You can give us a call, 813-996-2113, or you can check out our website at www.floridaestateswines.com. And we'd like to see you come out and visit us on our birthday. And we're going to have birthday cake, and we're going to have presents. Actually, door prizes, but since it's a birthday party, they're presents. So we're going to have birthday cake. We're going to have presents. We're going to have vendors. We're going to have entertainment. We're going to have all sorts of stuff there. And we're going to be celebrating 13 years in business. We're very happy and very proud of that, considering that the – And wait a minute, my engineer just yelled something at me. What? Oh, she reminded me we're pet friendly too. So if you have yourself pets, friendly leashed pets of any type, and it doesn't have to be dogs, it can be anything as long as they're friendly, bring them in. We are pet friendly also. If you bring in a pet food, you get 10% off of any purchase of wine. Pet food goes to a good cause, Pasco Pet Fest. So come out and see us. Come out and visit with us. Help us celebrate our 13th birthday. And the little lady just spoke in my ear and told me we only have about 60 seconds to go, so I'm not even going to play the outro. I'm just going to tell you all goodbye now. And we'll look forward to seeing you. If you'd like to get a hold of us at All About Wine, you can get a hold of us at allaboutwinebtr.com. That is the email, or you can check us out on Facebook, All About Wine, at Facebook. And we also have an All About Wine website, All About Wine. Oh, that's All About Wine BTR. The address is All About Wine 101. So, boy, I get those confused. Whatever. Thanks for tuning in. We'll look forward to hearing or seeing you all next week. We have another guest from Utah. They have been fun. They have been informative. And we'll continue on the pattern next week. We're looking at a guest next week. Have yourself a wonderful week. Hope to see you out there Saturday. goodbye, and have a good week.